This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Alabama is home to the most diverse forests and aquatic systems in this country, with more species per square mile than any other state. But Alabama's wild places have also suffered mightily since the 1800s and are at risk today, with species after species becoming extinct after generations of logging, mining, and other industry. Ben Raines captures the breathtaking natural beauty of his native Alabama through his photos and his words in his book, Saving America's Amazon, The Threat to Our Nation's Most Biodiverse River System, published by New South Books. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me, Ray. I'm really glad to be here.
When we talk about Alabama as a biodiversity hotspot, if somebody's hearing us say this for the first time, unpack that a little bit.
Well, it kind of is counterintuitive to the narrative we've heard about Alabama and the South in general, that these are places where in the public mind, it's all about civil rights movement, nowadays football and industry, steel mills and cotton and stuff like that. So missing in this is the natural landscape here, which somehow has not been celebrated the same way a lot of our other landscapes have been celebrated. You think of the West with the iconic mountains and that kind of stuff. But it turns out that one of the most biologically rich places in the United States is right here in the Southeast, and kind of the epicenter is Alabama. There are more animals and plants here per square mile than any other state. And in fact, there are twice as many as any other state. Now, following close behind Alabama in some of these categories is Tennessee. Tennessee also has very high aquatic diversity. You know, Alabama, for instance, has 97 species of crawfish or crayfish, the most in the nation by far. Tennessee has 83. So it's number two. And it's for the same reasons. You know, this part of the country didn't freeze during the ice ages the way so much of the country did. So many things that have evolved here are still here. They haven't died out. And so that's a huge factor when we talk about biodiversity, is the length of time things have had to evolve. And so here it's in the millions of years.
Part of the delta that you write about, part of that extends into here in Southeast Tennessee.
Well, it does. In fact, you know, this delta, the Mobile Tensaw Delta, which is named after the Mobile River, drains part of Tennessee, part of Mississippi, part of Georgia, and most of Alabama. So it's a huge drainage. And so it does pull in that diversity in the other states. You know, nationally, this is the third largest river system by water volume, after the Mississippi and the Columbia. So there's a lot of water coming through the state of Alabama. And, you know, water and plentiful sunlight, which we have, are kind of the magic recipes for life. If you have those two things in abundance, you'll have a lot of life, as opposed to where if you just have one or the other, say a desert where you don't have the water, they're rich habitats, but they are not abundant the way the South is.
And then how does the Tennessee River, which runs through here in Chattanooga, play into this at all?
Well, so it doesn't drain into this system naturally. You know, we have the 10-Tom waterway, which connects the Tennessee to the Tombigbee, which flows into this drainage. But the diversity along the Tennessee River corridor and that northern Alabama point, that's really one of the global hotspots for mussels. You know, the little basically living rocks in the water that filter the water. The lion's share of the world's mussel species are located in sort of the top half of Alabama and that touching chunk of Tennessee. And it's really stunning. And, you know, some of these mussels, people think of mussels like we eat, and that is a mussel, but that's one kind of mussel. You know, we have 150 some kinds in Alabama with these crazy names like heel splitters and pig toes and warty backs. And then some of them are gigantic. Some of them are literally as big around as like a cafeteria tray. And they're 100 years old. So to think of these shellfish in our rivers that were here at the end of the Civil War, it's really incredible.
And this biodiversity, it may be ignored or forgotten in this country, but scientists developing what became known as the theory of evolution, they turned to Alabama a few centuries ago.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things. If you go back 200, 100 years ago, Alabama was a place people came to see things that you couldn't see anywhere else. Whether that was giant dinosaur bones that were popping up out of the ground or the incredible array of flowers, things like that. Alabama was known as this place where you could see creatures that existed nowhere else. And so in the fossil record, Alabama's reputation, even by the late 1700s, was already global. So by the early 1800s, we had the Smithsonian crews here in 1810, 1835, collecting dinosaurs that are still on display in the Smithsonian Museums in Washington, D.C. Well, as these things were being discovered, Europeans were coming here too to get these Alabama bones and take back, in particular, a creature called the Zeuglodon. And now we call it a Bacillosaurus. But this was a 60 to 80 foot long aquatic. It was actually a whale, and it was preying on all these early dinosaurs and things in the water. Most of Alabama and parts of Tennessee were underwater for extensive periods, part of this great ocean. And that's when these creatures date to. So they're famous fossil formations related to when this was all underwater, all over the state. In particular, in Alabama, there's an area called the Claiborne Bluffs. There's a man named Charles Lyell, who was the father of modern geology, I mean, globally. And he was an English guy. And he actually came to Alabama to study the fossil formations here in 1850, just before the Civil War. And he was making comparisons to what he was seeing in the fossils in England, in France, and other places in Europe. And he was seeing that there were creatures that were common in both places. For instance, the Birmingham, England coal fields, and then Birmingham, Alabama, the coal fields there. He was seeing similar species. Then he was seeing species in each place that didn't live in the other across the ocean. So he had this idea that, wow, well, some things only live over there, but some of these live all over the place. It was the beginning of the theory of evolution. And he had this idea, looking at these things over time, he realized he was seeing a record of time, of history. With the different fossils, some, you know, they'd be really prominent in a layer, and then higher up in a more modern layer, they would have disappeared. Well, so Charles Lyell turned out to be Charles Darwin's mentor, and he wrote a book about geology that Darwin was really influenced by. When he sailed to the Galapagos on the Beagle, he wrote about, I'm seeing the world through Lyell's eyes, meaning he was seeing how these rock formations and the fossils were this record of time and everything. So Lyell, through his studies comparing Alabama and Europe, gave Darwin the element of time he needed to come up with the theory of evolution, the idea that creatures change over time in response to whatever, their environment or new conditions. But that idea that the Earth was millions of years old was a radical one when Lyell first posited it based on his trips here to the American South. Because at the time, the Church of England insisted the world was only 6,000 years old and that all creatures on it and everything that had ever happened in it lived in this brief little window. It irks some people to hear me say it, but Alabama played a pivotal role in the theory of evolution.
How about that for a plot twist?
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of plot twists, the story begins to change when we talk about America's Amazon with industrialization, whether we're talking about the steel mills you mentioned earlier or the coming of the dams.
Yeah. So from the very start, almost as soon as the scientists from other places were coming here to study our plants and animals, late 1700s, early 1800s, they also realized the industrial uses that could come from these rivers. And we began turning the rivers to our purposes in the 1800s, first building locks to facilitate barge traffic. Well, what that was about was getting cotton and coal from the top of the state down to the Gulf of Mexico. So we began altering the rivers back then. And our story with the rivers is very one-sided. It's all us taking from the rivers. And so what we've done now is created a very fractured system of the rivers. Alabama has 30 major dams, which is a very high number. And those dams together are responsible for more extinctions than any other factory in the history of the United States. In fact, since the 1850s, more than half of all U.S. extinctions have happened in Alabama. So we had all this diversity. We have all this diversity, but we've been whacking away at it, causing the extinction of different creatures for well over 100 years. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting situation where, yes, we are number one in aquatic diversity. More species of fish, turtles, mussels, snails, salamanders, all these things, but we're also the leader in the extinctions of all those same things. And we can't go on forever being the number one in diversity and the number one in extinctions. And so we're at this kind of moment where Alabama's got to decide if it's going to step up and protect this incredible biological heritage, which has all kinds of potential uses that we don't even understand yet. You know, we talk about the cure for cancer being found in the Amazonian rainforest. It's just as likely to be found here in these Alabama jungles, which have barely been explored. That's the really interesting thing. This idea of Alabama as a diverse place is new. Along with Tennessee and the rest of the South, this only was revealed in about 2002, when somebody finally added up all the species in every state. And people were stunned to see this tier of southern states high in the rankings. You know, Alabama is now the fourth highest state in overall diversity of all creatures. When I started writing the book, we were fifth. So we've knocked New Mexico off the list. Arizona only has 83 more species than Alabama. We're going to knock them off soon, because since I wrote the book, we've discovered well over 100 new species. We're finding new species here all the time. So that whack we've taken from industry is still devastating the state. Alabama has the weakest environmental laws in the nation. Alabama spends less to protect the environment than any other state and has for decades. And you see that here. The state's attitude toward regulating industry is completely unusual and out of step with all other states. And the difference is how we enforce pollution laws. In Alabama, you know, in most states, Tennessee, for instance, the pollution is measured by the regulators at the pipe where it comes out of a factory and hits the river. You have to be down to that level of pollution at the end of the pipe. In Alabama, they give industry a mixing zone of a mile in the river. So the pollution level that's enforced in other states, in Alabama, industry can dump raw toxins straight in the water. As long as a mile downstream, they're down to the permitted level where the other states have to be at the pipe. Alabama has made a decision to use our rivers as industrial sewage treatment plants. And there's no other way to say it. That's a fact.
And you have covered that in your journalism, and you have practiced that in your environmental activism. And you are a charter captain. To the extent that somebody can get out there and see all of this firsthand, you do it all the time.
In fact, I was on the water yesterday. And, you know, I was out almost every day in April, and it's just magnificent. I will provide you a link to a little video I put up that shows people what this place looks like and why I call it America's Amazon. And it's a stunning wilderness. This is one of the largest contiguous wilderness wetland complexes in North America. You can get in the boat. You're 5 minutes from downtown Mobile. And within 5 minutes from the boat ramp, you are in a wilderness where it would be very easy to die. You could get eaten by an alligator, eaten by a bull shark, bit by five different kinds of poisonous snakes, killed by a small bobcat or a bear. And this is all 5 minutes from the boat ramp. It's a true wilderness, and it is glorious. The flowers, the birds, you know, we have 280 species of migrating birds that come through. So when you get out there, it is, I've had people who've been to the Amazon, people who've been to Vietnam, to the jungles there, who say this is a jungle, a world-class jungle on par with those. And it really is. I invite people to come down and get on the boat for a day. It's a transformative experience. No one understands that this exists in Alabama. And most people don't understand this exists in America, this kind of wilderness. It's a spectacular place.
How did you decide to become a charter captain, and what did it take to become one?
So I became a charter captain because I was a longtime newspaper reporter and could see the newspaper industry disintegrating around me, and said, you know, I need a fallback. And I am a good fisherman, and I've spent a lot of time on the water. And I said, I think I'll get a captain's license. And I did that with an eye toward either taking people fishing or taking people up in the Delta. So I started about 7 years ago running tours. It quickly became apparent to me that the right direction for me was nature tours. Based on my career, I've built a skill set that is different from what a fishing charter captain, you know, has. I mean, I can go catch a fish, but I can also identify all the little bugs and birds and flowers and things we see. And I've learned my way around this giant swamp, which, you know, we're talking about 300,000 acres, and it is full of twisty, turny streams and sandbars. And, you know, I pull a lot of people off mud bars who get stuck out there because they don't know where they're going. But, you know, it's been a great side gig that's become one of my main ways to make a living. You know, I'm no longer a practicing daily journalist. A lot of times that feels like a really good thing these days when you see the latest rounds of cuts at newspapers and things. But that's why the book was so important to me. I want to communicate the importance of these areas. I want to communicate how delicate they are, how close we are to losing them, and how close we are to saving them, and to try and help people make the decision towards saving them through, you know, sharing my love for it. I mean, I look at the book as a love letter to Alabama's wild places. I hope a lot of other people read it and fall in love with them too.
And for people who want to follow all that you do online, where can they go?
Well, I have a Facebook page, and if you want to be my friend, I will be your friend. I have an Instagram page, and those are my two kind of main outlets. I'm happy to email with people or message with people or whatever if they want to hear about the charters. There's an NPR story about taking one of my charters from a few years ago. And you know, the Delta is an incredible place. There are all kinds of mysteries out there. And one of the largest and most spectacular would be the last slave ship, the last ship that brought enslaved Africans to America, which I actually found in the Delta, the Clotilda. And I have a new book coming out in January about that. But, you know, the idea that this swamp was somewhere big enough that you could hide a ship and have it remain hidden for 160 years tells you a lot about the swamp and its kind of magic and mystery. It's that kind of place where you can get lost and never be found.
Well, Ben, I'm glad that I found out about this book, and I thank you for your time, and I look forward to speaking with you about the next book in the next year.
Can't wait. You know, if people want to buy the book and are having trouble finding it, it's certainly on Amazon and all that. A lot of local bookstores have it, certainly in Alabama. And if you can't track a copy down or you want a signed copy, reach out to me through Facebook, and I will try and work out getting you one.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
All right, thank you, Rick.
On this week leading up to Juneteenth, Shane Morrow of Rise Chattanooga brings us a celebration of Black Music Month.
The month of June, to most Americans, marks the start of an array of celebrations, graduations, weddings, the official start to summer. But did you know that this is also the month in which we commemorate Juneteenth celebration and National African American Music Month? On June 19th, 1865, 2.5 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, Union General Granger led thousands of federal troops to Galveston, Texas, to announce that the Civil War has ended and slaves have been freed. That order laid the foundation for Juneteenth, the oldest national observed celebration commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. Black Music Month started after the hit-making Philly soul music producer Kenny Gamble visited Nashville in the 1970s and was inspired by the Country Music Association and how they highlighted the economic strength by spearheading Country Music Month every October. So in 1978, Gamble started the Black Music Association, which quickly built a network of high-level supporters, including Stevie Wonder, Motown Records founder Berry Gordy, and Reverend Jesse Jackson. In less than a year, Gamble, along with media strategist Dana Williams, alongside with radio DJ Ed Wright, founded Black Music Month. On June 7th, 1979, President Jimmy Carter held the first ever Black Music Month celebration right in front of the White House lawn.
How many of you know what month this is? Somebody said June. Right on. This is Black Music Month. As you know, the purpose of the Black Music Association is to preserve, protect, and perpetuate black music on an international basis. And the time to do it on an international basis is right now at the White House, the center of your government. And Rosen and I are very glad to have you here. The Black Music Association is not an old organization, but it was one that was organized at the right time, in the right place, for the right reason. It's only a year old, but I understand already has 2,000 members. And tomorrow in Philadelphia, you'll have your founders meeting in a very appropriate place. As you know, our own nation was founded in Philadelphia. And I was thinking this afternoon that if we had had the Black Music Association organized 203 years ago, so that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington could have just heard some of this music at the very beginning, our country could have avoided a lot of trouble and a lot of heartache and a lot of struggle and a lot of suffering and a lot of division and would be even greater than it is now. It's important in my opinion, for our own nation and the rest of the world to know the importance that the President of the United States and his family and friends attach to black music. Because in many ways, the feelings of our own black citizens throughout the history of our country has been accurately expressed in the music. And it presents a kind of history of our nation when you go back and see the evolution of black music. It's meant a lot to me as a young boy and a young man and adult in Georgia. I won't make the other states feel inferior by naming all the black musicians that have come out of Georgia. I'll be nice to you this afternoon. But I think that it's accurate to say that in many ways the deep feelings of pain and suffering, of alienation and a sense of being an outcast in one's own community, in one's own nation, a sense of hope and a sense of unity, a sense of deep religious faith, a sense of vision, sense of beauty, has been expressed very deeply and in forceful terms in black music, not only for me from the South, but for all Americans, both black and white. And it's obvious that this has not been limited to the United States of America. There's been a transcendent effect of black music that has never paid any attention to international borders. I think black music is a way to tie the black people of our country to their own ancestors and to tie the United States to other nations of the world. It's been an avenue for understanding and friendship that has been effective when politicians could not succeed. In many ways, you've expressed the hopes of our country, life, even when slavery was a characteristic of black people, liberty and a struggle for it when it seemed to escape generation after generation of struggling people. And no one can doubt that black music has always exemplified the pursuit of happiness. So in many ways, I think that you have not only mirrored and described what was happening in our country, but you have presented a guide in times of despair and failure to what our country ought to be.
21 years later, in 2000, Black Music Month was finally recognized. Officially, President Clinton actually made Black Music Month an official proclamation that year, with the stated purpose of recognizing the importance of African-American music to global culture and calling on the people of the United States to study, reflect on, and celebrate African-American music. President Obama renamed it African-American Music Appreciation Month during his first term in 2009. Join us for our second part of this special segment celebrating Black Music Month with an interview with local artist Jermaine Purifoy.
Shane Morrow, thank you. The music you heard is part of Rise Chattanooga's upcoming EP Spiritual Remixed project, featuring all local artists. They will perform some of the songs at Rise's Live on the Big Nine, Music for the Soul, in Chattanooga's Miller Plaza on Sunday, June 27th. More information at risecha.org. That's risecha.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon from the Isis Theatre in Asheville, we have a set from the group No Depression Magazine called The Future of Bluegrass, led by 18-year-old multi-instrumentalist Liam Purcell, This is Cane Mill Road.
If you want to find me, honey, I'll be somewhere down that road. When just a day behind me, moving on down a heavy load. My spirit's like the wind, trying to find what's round the bend.
Y'all so much. Good evening. How are you doing? Man, I love being able to see everybody by candlelight, especially y'all front row people. Don't worry, I see you on the balcony too. I got you. I got y'all. All right. Well, if you were alive and had your radio on in the year 1970, you might remember this number. Yeah? Yeah. Heck yeah. You might remember this number. It's a little one that you definitely have heard. I won't spoil it, but if you know it, sing along. If you don't know it, you will by the end. Trust me.
Thank you. like wine, and that low-down southern whiskey began to fog my mind. And I don't remember church bells or the money I put down on the white picket fence and boardwalk of the house at the edge of town. Oh, but boy, do I remember the strain of her refrain and the nights we spent together and the way she called my name. And guitar player she could play. She always liked to sing along. He was always handy with the song. Then one night in the lobby of the Commodore Hotel, I chanced to meet a bartender who said he knew her well. And as he handed me a drink, he began to hum a song. And all the boys who at the bar began to sing along. If you be my Dixie Chicken, I'll be your Tennessee Lamb.
Let me hear you, boys.
And we can walk together down in Dixieland. Down in Dixieland.
It's a cautionary tale for you. That's Colton Kirchner singing for you, everybody. You know, we've been to Memphis recently, and it turns out there's not a Commodore Hotel in Memphis. There never was. Can't tell you how long me and Colton spent in the van just looking for where the heck that song came from. That was Little Feet, in case you didn't know. And a little cover we've been doing lately. Yeah, no Commodore Hotel. There's the Peabody. Maybe that's what they meant. Oh, my goodness. What a fun night, y'all. We're going to play another one off the new album, Roots. This is one I wrote called Final Days.
There's a standstill inbound and the metro is down. The office is crowded when I get into town. Gathering clouds threaten me, I can't see them yet. My old dog stays inside when he knows it'll rain. My grandma does too, cause her joints give her pain. I see the signs, yet I'm willfully blind to the truth. You're all I've got from this world of sorrow. You make me wanna look past tomorrow, but it's too late now. Our love is bound to die. I didn't know beauty could make me cry, but look at me looking through cloudy eyes, looking at what's left of our lives in these final days. I made 35,000 decisions in a day, not bearing a sound, but I question the way. I never worried about nothing back when I was a child. You wanna give me it all, which I surely admire, but I do not possess one single worthy desire. The world is mine, but how can I be trusted? Our future, it's shot to hell, so enjoy what water is still in the well. It's too late now, our well's running dry. I didn't know beauty could make me cry, but look at me looking through cloudy eyes. Look at what's left of our lives in these final days. Mother, and likewise your father, 'cause one day you'll grow up and have your own sons and daughters. Care for them well, 'cause one day they'll take care of you. Now, there's a reason they say that life's like a cycle, but looking at history, it's one big downward spiral. But for my part, you're the reason that it ends. Left of our lives in these final days.
Play one that came from Towns Van Zandt here. It's a little number called the White Freightliner. Fire at will, maestro.
Going out on my way, going to them big trucks, my. I'm going out on my way, going to them big trucks, my. Now, white friend, I don't want to steal you away, my mind. Mm-hmm.
bad news from Houston. Half of my friends are dying. Well, it's bad news from Houston. Half my friends are dying. Now, White Fiddle, I don't want you still to wear my mind. I'm going out on the highway, gonna steal them big trucks mine. I'm going out on the highway, gonna steal them big trucks mine. Now, White Fiddle, I don't want you still to wear my mind. In New Mexico, Lord, they treat you fine. Those people in New Mexico, Lord, they treat you fine. Now, White Fiddle, I don't want you still to wear my mind. I'm going out on the highway, gonna listen to them big trucks whine. I'm going out on the highway, gonna listen to them big trucks whine. Now I'm afraid that I don't want you steal away my mind. Oh, play that funky band. Thank you so much, folks. We'll see you soon. I'm going to leave you with a one of my tune from one of my favorite bluegrass bands of all time. I think hands down they take the cake. A little old string band called the Grateful Dead. Like wild geese flying to the west, Lord. I know your rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. I know your rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. You're gonna miss your baby rolling in your was a headlight on that northbound train. I wished I was a headlight on that northbound train. I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues all away. 'Cause I know your rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. I know your rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. Gonna miss your baby rolling in your arms. It doesn't matter where I am tomorrow. It doesn't matter where I am today. With what's ahead and what's behind me, I'd still be feeling this old way. 'Cause I know you rider, you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. I know you rider, gonna miss me when I'm gone. You're gonna miss your baby rolling in your arms. You're gonna miss your baby rolling in your arms. You're gonna miss your baby.
throwing in your arms.
One more tap, good measure. Everybody, give it up for Rob McCormick on guitar.
Jacob Smith's playing bass for you this evening.
Colton Kirchner on the banjo.
And my name's Liam Purcell.
Thank you so much. Have a good night, y'all.
From Deep Gap in North Carolina, this is Cane Mill Road, live in the Isis Theater in Asheville this past Friday, June 11th. The complete show with video is on the Isis Theater Facebook page. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.